Thank you so much again, Steve, that you were here and that you gave us a presentation. You told me you wanted to make a presentation today about art and law.
Thank you all for coming. I have to say, it expresses your true dedication to come out on a Sunday afternoon in art festival. A couple of caveats before I'm beginning. I'm going to really expand a little bit beyond law and talk about just disciplinarity and how that relates to expression management. Because any of us that do interventionist work or that produce critical art in one way or another know that it is a constant struggle, right? That it's not something that you can just go out and do and not expect there to be consequences. And the consequences can range in incredibly broad fashion. It's quite a large spectrum, from ones that are somewhat absurd all the way to very extreme consequences, as those of you that saw the show next door. So one of the things I'm often asked, and this is, I guess, where we can start and connect this talk to what's over there, is how did that happen? How did this run-in with the FBI occur? Why did it occur? And the answer to that is pretty broad. Now, on the surface, it looks like it's just this kind of Kafkaesque existential absurdity, and probably in an existential manner. To me, it was. It was a very senseless, ungrounded, and confusing experience. But if we step back for a moment and look at what I was doing, my activities and behavior, and my relationship then to the FBI and the Department of Justice, there's a very clear logic to it. It's complicated, and it has lots of registries or layers. But it all makes sense that, you know, that we can, I think, point out the various objectives that the Department of Justice had when they came across my work. It wasn't necessarily random. It wasn't something that they didn't think about. They just went off in a crazy way, although it certainly can appear that way. There was an agenda behind it, and some of it was successful. So what were they doing? Well, on a very concrete level, part of it was just ambition. And if you're familiar with Western New York, we have a very large Yemeni population there outside Buffalo. And the prosecutor who prosecuted me had just come off a very successful campaign in what he called exposing a sleeper cell of terrorists. What he actually did was he locked up some poor teenage kids that, you know, perhaps had made a mistake. It was before 9/11, these kids had gone to Pakistan and then made their way into Afghanistan and had been at one of the terrorist training camps. The one on the news with the monkey bars that you see all the time whenever they play the stock footage, they went to that camp. And they were thinking that maybe they were going to be part of either resistance in Chechnya or Bosnia. But they got there and there was all this anti-American activity going on, and they left as quickly as they could, came back to the US. The FBI knew that they had been, followed them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 2 years. These kids never did anything. They were just living the life that teenage kids had do. And after 9/11, Bush gave the order to have them arrested as part of his idea of, well, it's actually John Ashcroft's idea, the Attorney General, of preemptive justice. So they were coming off this big victory where they had put some kids and saved America from sleeper cells. The FBI got a much bigger budget from this because it was a terrorist hotspot. And the Department of Justice, they all went to the White House and got medals for outstanding achievement. The leader of the U.S. Attorney of Western New York that kind of led this investigation, he was promoted to be the second in charge under Alberto Gonzalez. Later, he was run out of the Department of Justice in disgrace for his role in Attorneygate, which was basically using the Justice Department to settle ideological scores with political rivals. So there was that. So there was this ambition involved in it too, and that I think played a very big role in really getting started. Everyone was saying, "We're all getting promotions. We, you know, and we've got a real sucker here." The other thing was for the FBI is doing what they do. I mean, what they really guarantee is private property. And they guarantee your right to private property and that it will stay privatized. And so what we were doing, this was particularly in the science, which is where they were looking at, is they really considered molecular biology and microbiology to be the property of the corporations and of the military. And anyone that was going to challenge that, to say that it doesn't belong just to that institution, that actually it is a public domain activity that we should all be involved in and must be involved in if we're to be reasonable citizens in a democratic state that is supposedly making policy on what new science is producing at a very rapid rate. Their position was, no, that's not the case. Those that you remember, the Bush administration, which was pretty much a neo-fascist administration, they liked it the old-fashioned way where you would have self-appointed bureaucrats by the White House and expert panels that they would also appoint, and that's who should make policy, that it really shouldn't be a matter of the public. And we were arguing quite the opposite in both ways, that we had a right to do amateur science and that this should be part of democratic production of politics. So you can see they didn't like that very much. The other thing that was on that agenda by us doing that was challenging the frame of science itself, the storybook frame of it, which, again, the FBI very much wanted to protect, right? And that's the idea that science is this neutral, value-free, fact-finding discipline, and that somehow it stands separate from the political sphere. And again, we're showing exactly the opposite, how politicized science is. And yes, while it may be somewhat neutral in the way it investigates a given phenomenon, once that knowledge is produced, it's all politics on how that knowledge will be distributed and applied. That's still something, again, apparently you're not supposed to talk about in polite company. So there was that level. Then they also had the intimidation plan, and I was like the perfect person for this. The three demographics that the FBI has consistently gone after since its inception, I mean since it started in the early 20th century, has been activist communities, artist communities, and academics, particularly academics in social sciences and humanities. And so I'm perfect, I'm all three. Right? So it's like I could be held up to each community of this is what we'll do to you if you behave in this manner. Right? I mean, this is very extreme expression management that we're talking about. We'll get to more subtle forms in a minute. But the unfortunate part about this campaign is it worked. And they knew it would work whether they got the conviction or not. Because no one wants to go through what I just went through. Let me tell you, you know, 4 years of defending yourself and being hounded by the FBI and being on probation and having all your every move watched and, you know, taking drug tests, peeing in bottles. So, to some degree, I think they did fairly well with that. And that intimidation program, they even spread into science dealerships that were selling various supplies to amateurs, right, to people outside of institutions that were doing their own scientific investigation. And oddly enough, a lot of these companies were foreign suppliers. They weren't even, you know, American companies who kind of bowed down to this FBI request, even though they're completely within their rights and completely within the realm of legality to sell the products they were selling, just as I was in my rights to buy the products that they were selling. The FBI didn't really agree with that, right? Then we have the policy of preemptive justice. If something looks like it could lead to a problem, stop it right away. And this was the Department of Justice means to parallel Bush's policy of preemptive war, right? That the reason you have a war is to actually start to stop another war that's happening. I don't even understand the lies. It's almost impossible to even articulate, right? And it's the same with this preemptive justice idea. You know, you find a crime to charge someone with so that they don't commit a crime later. It's really kind of a very strange form of thought policing, and to make those things, to make thoughts and crimes interchangeable. So I fell into that net as well, right? That was the standard policy of preemptive, and I had written some books. The two that they didn't like the most was when I wrote one called Electronic Civil Disobedience and another one called Fuzzy Biological Sabotage, in which I just explained how corporate techniques that have been used against farmers and citizens could be reappropriated and used back against authority. Needless to say, they were not keen on that idea, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. The other thing that went with this was what I call creating alibis. Because as we know, most of what the FBI was doing, particularly in this period, was aimed at Middle Easterners, right? And it was completely disproportionate of how people of Middle Eastern descent were being treated compared to anybody else. I mean, the joke on the street in the U.S. was black people are coming, finally we can pass this baton to the next, you know, someone's taking the bottom rung now. So there was that it was a good thing because it's like, see, we arrest white people too, right? And so this kind of institutionalized racism could get a bit of a whitewash on it. And again, I fit the bill very well. And so in addition to that one too, getting the alibi and kind of their excuse for racism was they had the opportunity to expand the enemy within. And one of the things the Bush administration was very keen on doing was not just saying there are terrorists out there that want to come into the country and blow you up. They wanted to say, it's everywhere. It's homegrown. And this was the great thing that they could do. It's like, you know, sometimes the terrorist could be an Al-Qaeda member from Afghanistan. Sometimes it's the art teacher next door. You never know. So yeah, and they really tried to work that angle quite successfully of creating this completely false sense of an enemy within, which of course always goes along with any authoritarian government. It's not just outside coming in, it's always inside going out as well. And the final thing was just the legal element that my case was a test case for them to see if they could implode civil and criminal law, to see if they could make those things one and the same. Because once they could accomplish that, once they could say a contract dispute is the same as criminality, and they had the arbitrary right to judge which it is, I mean, that's able to put yourself as a serious threat. It would have doubled the Justice Department's power overnight if they had gotten away with it. Happily, the case was dismissed and they didn't get close. But it was quite a scary time. Because that would have meant they would have had a great felony charge with a sentence of 20 years. And they could pretty much charge anyone they wanted to with it, because almost nobody goes through life without ever having a contra dispute of some type. So, I mean, these were just some of the logics that were spinning through the case, and some were very concrete, some were very abstract, some was just ideological positioning. But it's all of these things. It wasn't just kind of this absurd moment. It was, you know, one of these key moments in the logic of neo-fascism in the United States. But it doesn't always have to be that extreme, right? It's that many of the times we're faced with the same kind of disciplinarity and on the most mundane levels instead of this quite exciting, high-level, and highly intense style that I was describing before. So most of the time, it's like this. This is a part of a much larger project that we were working on called the Winnebago Project. This was one piece we did. And we spent 3 days in a camper driving around Florida, stopping at all the sites off the highways and doing little projects. You know, sometimes it was corner video. Sometimes we do slideshows. It was back in the 90s, so we still had slides. You know, various kinds of projects like this. But the one that relates to what we're talking about here today is this project, Are We There Yet? And what we wanted to talk about in this project was the layer of disciplinarity, right? The layer of the law that was around us all the time, guiding behavior. Even though usually it's invisible, it doesn't call attention to itself, you don't always see it, it's there. And the gesture that we chose to bring to elicit this effect, I guess it's like Kreskin, it was an effect we were doing more than a performance, was to elicit this effect was to have our performance artists there set up Hot Wheels track. Some of you may remember those toys from your childhood, a little track. And he had a little toy Winnebago, a little toy camper van that he would push around the track. And, I mean, we notched it up a little bit. He has a boombox there, and it's playing a montage of car crash sounds and kids asking, when are we going to get there? And we did also put a Burger King crown on his head. But basically, we're not doing anything illegal. We're not blocking the right of way. Everybody can move around. And this particular manifestation is at Daytona Beach. And if you're familiar with Daytona Beach, you know, it seems like this very open place where all behavior, it's like Amsterdam, where all behaviors are tolerated. But actually, it's like Amsterdam, amazingly managed. You know, everything is managed. And, you know, so you can drive around on the beach, people are racing up and down, you know, people are strapping bungee cords to themselves and diving off cranes, and, you know, girls are going wild, the whole thing is happening. And as long as you're spending money, right, you're involved in these, and drinking or whatever it is you want to, it's okay, you know. But the minute that you stop that and cause a distraction that causes that cash flow to slow in any way, if you throw any inertia into the system, you got a problem. And you have one really fast. And we knew that that's what we were doing. Is people are stopping, they're looking at what he's doing, and all he's doing is pushing the car. I don't know what was so interesting about it. But people stopped to look. And within a couple of minutes, I mean every time we did it, the police would show up. And the police there, what they're discussing with each other is what they're going to arrest them for. And they finally decide that the charge would be public nuisance, that they're going to arrest him as a public nuisance. And, you know, this was kind of an enlightening piece for us at the same time, because we realized that really anyone could be arrested anytime purely at the whim of the police. And there are all these ridiculous laws on the books to do it. I don't know if it's true here in Germany, but I suspect that it probably is. It's been like that in most places I've visited, that it doesn't take much to break what is standard, acceptable means of behavior, even if what you're doing is completely legal, right? In this case, it's the slightest of deviant gestures, right? It's an adult playing with a child's toy. But that was enough to bring the police out. And as I said, they came every time. So that's the kind of this level, this everyday life level, that any of us that do any intervention, whether it's in a private space or pseudo-public space, I don't really believe in public space, that it exists. And, you know, there's some places we have better access to than others, and there's some places we have a wider latitude of the way we may behave or express ourselves. But that's kind of as far as it goes. Yeah. However, if one participates in those spaces, this kind of authority is always there. Okay. Yes?
What was he arrested?
He didn't get arrested. He quit. He stopped. He said, please don't arrest me. I'll stop now. And they said, okay, you know, pack up your stuff and get out of here. So we didn't go to jail. The beautiful part of this one, this did not always happen, but the beautiful part of this one was the crowd began to realize someone was about to be arrested for playing with a toy. And it made them angry. And, you know, we weren't there to start a riot. It was like, okay, point made, stop. You know, it's like, That was not what we were going after. So, you know, CAE has had this very long history. In fact, we have a whole lecture that's just about problems we've had with the police because of trying to do something in public space, never any of it illegal. And this is kind of one of the key struggles for us, is to keep the possibility of being able to behave the way we want within the legal sphere, because it's like it's being shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. Right? It's particularly bad in the U.S. right now, and it's not quite as bad in Europe as it is there. Yes?
I was just curious, approximately how many times did he do his little racetrack thing, and was it always in a different place?
Yeah, it was in a different place every time. This time, you can see, he didn't even finish setting it up yet before the cops were there. Now, normally, it's not always as an extreme response. For instance, if we did it on the highway where you can pull off and there's toilets, there's a rest stop. Like, if you do it there, there's going to be some old security guard or something that's going to come out and say, quit doing that, right? You know, the level of militarization does change with the amount of investment that's in the location. The more the investment, the more police. You know, the less the investment is something like it's just a public toilet. That's all that's there. There's none. But, you know, anywhere that we did it, it was pretty instant. I mean, you try doing something like this at a mall or someplace, a shopping center. I mean, you don't last 30 seconds before there's police there.
Any kind of thing like that, but are there not permits for doing things like this that can prevent you from getting arrested?
No, there's no permits to do that. You know, the only time that you need permits is if you're assembling, if you're assembling a large amount of people. But theoretically, in any public spot, you're acting within the limits of the law, you should be left alone, but that's not what happens. Unfortunately.
And street artists like musicians or
those are they're usually tolerated, right? Because they're not slowing down. They're helping. They're helping that circulation continue. They're helping the money to flow. They're not going to be bothered. Now there's some places, you know. I mean, if you were bothering people and you were in some exclusive part of town with 5-star restaurants and you set up and start singing. You would probably be arrested, yes, because then you're not helping anymore. But if it was a place like Daytona, that would be fine, because there you're helping. You know, you can almost judge these things perfectly. It's nearly a one-to-one correlation in the relationship between the commodity and the amount of militarization.
But you use quite, militarization is quite an extreme concept for this.
I mean, woman's got her hand on her gun. What do you want to call it? It is the secret layer of a very violent form of discipline. And, you know, they've got their tasers ready, which has become an incredible problem in the U.S. right now. We have trigger-happy taser cops. Right there. I don't know what other word to use, really. I'm not saying that entire social sphere is militarized, but I'm saying there is this layer that's there, and it's there for very serious enforcement of the smallest infractions if it stops this circulation. You know, to disrupt that status quo, it's there to be as violent as you want to go with it. So generally we try not to. Right? This is a project, another very friendly intervention. A very friendly intervention that was the first time we were ever called terrorists. Right? This was after 2001, so now it wasn't like before, like that piece that I just showed you. That one was done in the early 90s, so we weren't called terrorists for doing that. Whereas now I guess we would be. So Halifax begs your pardon. We were up in Canada. And we were asked there to come and kind of work with one of the community arts centers and the Nova Scotia School of Art and Design. And we said, okay, we'll come up and do something. And they wanted to do something that they felt, you know, meshed well with their space that they were living in. And in Halifax, it was summer. It's a very popular tourist destination, and rightly so. It's a very nice town with incredible landscapes around it. They thought, you know, what would be interesting is if we could give a tour to the tourists of all the public secrets of Halifax, right? It's things that we all know, but nobody's ever going to tell a tourist. It's like, why don't we put together a tour like that? And so that we did just that. there was a lot to apologize for, as it turned out. And, you know, it's also making fun of the Canadian tendency to over-apologize for elements. So a lot of work putting it together. We had sorry bricks and sorry flags and all kinds of ways that we could apologize for things. We had sorry digital tags so that we could run longer apologies if we needed to. A lot of stuff. So we started, I guess, you know, with the statue that we opened up with. That was the founder of Halifax, who was not just known for being the founder of Halifax, but also the person who instigated the scalping of Native American policies in Nova Scotia. So we gave him a sword. He even got to be on the cover of the pamphlet for the tour for that one. This was the old site of Africville, which in the 60s, the town fathers decided that this African population needed to be moved, that they could no longer stay there. And not only did they need to be moved, they needed to be atomized, meaning they could not move en masse. They had to each break up and move their own separate ways. I mean, so not just moving them, but destroying this social constellation as well. And we thought that deserves some sorries. Put extra ones in for that, all four. And, you know, and it wasn't all, I mean, these were pretty bad public secrets, but it was playful like this. The worst piece of public sculpture I've ever seen. I mean, this is just a scandal. And it's supposed to be a wave celebrating Halifax's maritime heritage. Yet, I mean, it looks like just this gray blob, and if it wasn't for that the kids could play on it, it would be completely irredeemable. But anyway, it got a sorry. We put one, that one definitely. The penis kiosks, that were all over the city. We put big sorry flags on all of those. I don't know what that designer was thinking, or maybe I do. I don't, you know, it's... latency. It has its cost. Alright, and then we had like little gizmos that we could install in local gyms and at the ATMs, and they would apologize for various problems. So it was a big day, you know. We had our sorry tour guides. There they are. They've got their sorry t-shirts on. We were advertising with pirate radio. So that was fun. And a little station telling him to take the sorry tour. We went down to the Bureau, Tourist Bureau, and there it is. There's ours, right next to Heritage Village. So you could get your little pamphlet and enjoy a wonderful walk along the waterside. But what unfortunately, because you're thinking, what can go wrong? I mean, this was such a friendly thing that we were doing. We weren't trying to antagonize anyone, we weren't trying to start trouble, but unfortunately we did. And it happened with one of these gizmos, and you can see by the hand, so you can see what the scale is of this thing. It's tiny, it's a tiny, tiny little screen, this. And so we had one, and one of the things we wanted to apologize for was the open sewage in the harbor. For the longest time, they had been trying to build a sewage treatment plant, but no one wants it in their neighborhood. So the alternative was to just pour it into the harbor, and when you took the ferry from Halifax to Dartmouth, as you go across the harbor, you go through all these really sludgy, awful places. And we thought we should probably apologize to the tourists that are having to do that. So, you know, I said we apologize for the sewage in the harbor. Well, we stuck that on the ferry, and it wasn't long before one of the people who were working on the ferry found it, and we just put it on the double stick tape. It wasn't screwed on. We didn't vandalize anything in installing this, and he took it off. And then when he got to the other side, he went into the main office. Now, from here we're putting it together through newspaper articles of what happened. But it seems that he gave it to his supervisor, and his supervisor looked at it and said, well, can't be too careful these days. We'll inform the police. Which is, of course, always a mistake. Never call the police for anything. They're just going to take a bad situation and make it worse. And the police come, and because of the war on terror thing, they had just gotten new bomb equipment in. So they get there, they look at it and go, it's a bomb! And it gets worse. They close the harbor, all the bridges, stop all the ferries, stop all of the ships trying to come in and unload. They shut it all down. And it's on Friday, right as everyone's getting out of work to go home. It's a total disaster. And it's all because they had this robot. They wanted to go and get in, and they grabbed it, and they dropped the gizmo into liquid nitrogen. And they did. And it's because they wanted to use their robot. I don't know why they couldn't just use their robot without closing the whole harbor. But they did. And we didn't know, because we had finished the tour by that time, and had gone out and were doing my artist do, drinking beer at the beach, and the next day, one of the guys that were there saying, you know, we should go get a newspaper, see if anybody noticed anything. You know, maybe back on page 6 of the culture section, there'll be something. And he comes back with the 2 Halifax newspapers, and both of them similar headlines, terrorist attack. He's like, I think they noticed. Oh man, I'm thinking, you gotta be kidding me. We're gonna have to flee Canada now. But it was, I think, realized fairly quickly that this was an overreaction. The journalists figured it out first, especially because they found our pamphlet that had everything mapped of where to go to see everything that we did. And the police were beginning their investigation for criminal mischief, which actually is a pretty heavy charge in Canada. It's a misdemeanor in the U.S., but there it's more serious. And I'm thinking, you know, how do we get so carried away? But what was on our side was there had been a G8 meeting there shortly before we got there. This was even on our tour. We had sorry bricks down for it. And there had been a G8 meeting, and much like just this past week in Pittsburgh, you know, where in this case it was only a few hundred protesters showed up, they brought in police from everywhere in full riot gear, gave them new tear gas guns, and said, you know, protect the Coliseum, you know, this their convention center. So the 300 protesters are, you know, beating their drums and yelling for forgive the dead, or, you know, you've been there. And they decide to fire tear gas. And no one had explained to them the laws of physics. And this was a real problem. Because as we all know, because tear gas is made to be heavier than air, so it stays on the ground, so it gases everybody really well. And the convention center is way up on the top of the hill, and Halifax is built into this slope going down into the harbor. Yes, so everyone can figure, you don't have to be a genius to figure this out, that if you shoot the gas at the top of the hill, it's going to go down the hill, which it did, and it gassed all the tourists. So they were already known for overreacting, and had already had to apologize before, so then they had to apologize again. But all the same, we weren't waiting around. I think we left Canada the next day anyway. So, you know, these are the kind of things that can happen. But back closer to home in the exhibition, this is a good one. and how much time needed for implementation. So here, this was one of the first projects where we ever really set up a public laboratory and did molecular work. I mean, I don't have time to explain all of this project exactly, but it was an investigation into reproductive technologies, IVF in particular. And we had created a false company and looking for donors. And we were very much interested in the donor profile. Let's see. Let me go back. See if I can show you that donor profile. It's a horrifying document, to be sure. And so we were just doing a lot of things like that. Okay, here it is. And we didn't do it. We didn't make this up. This was taken right out of a fertility clinic. This is, you know, I know it's going to look like we made this up, but we didn't. Okay, so you don't have to look at this for very long to understand there's something going on here besides just checking medical records for genetically transmitted diseases. You know, why they need to know your hair type, your present hair loss. You know, all babies, I'm worried about it. I don't know why they need to know that. Eye color, skin color, special interests and hobbies. But then it really starts getting weird. What describes you at age 20? Which best describes your musical ability? Do you have any other skills in the fine arts? This is interesting because you didn't always see this one. We found one clinic in California that part of their guarantee of quality was they did not take any DNA from artists. So there. It was. It's like the kooky gene stops right there. That will not be passed on in our service. So, you know, it's kind of how often do you lose your temper, allowing for your physical stamina, physical activity, intelligence, of course, that goes without saying, even though, you know, that's probably not all in the genes. Are you tactful and work well with your associates? So, how many children do you have? That's important. So, you know, clearly they're getting at another thing, and it becomes very clear as you go through the test that what they're doing, giving the parents the advantage to the babies, is basically to make them good little capitalist workers. Right? I mean, it's all about how long can you stand to sit in front of a screen in a cube and not want to kill somebody, right? And that's what they're looking for. That's the values they've got listed. Because if you look for something like, oh, let's say empathy or, you know, charitable qualities like that, you're not going to find them, right? They don't care about any of that stuff. That's not what sells. Empathetic kids. But, you know, a kid that doesn't lose his temper very much and doesn't get bored and can work hard, lots of stamina, with good manual dexterity. Now, there's some stuff we can use, right? All right, so people, you know, took that test, and then if they passed it, it was hard to pass. And I have to say, every member of Critical Art Ensemble failed it. We're all totally genetic lowlifes. So, you know, you got that if you passed. And it would be, you know, and most people, though, they just got sorry, you know, your genes do not meet our quality expectations. But if you got that one, you know, you did good. So people, you know, would actually get upset, even though everyone knew it was theater, we weren't a real company or anything like that. You could feel the separation besides those that could go on and would have their photo taken and we would take their DNA and amplify it and we'd take a cell sample from them. So, you know, we had a cryopreservation laboratory as well. So it was, you know, it was quite a process. And then, you know, at the end of it, I mean, it's just for a minute, we tried to pass the hat. and say, we have a frozen, which we did, we lived with this couple as they went through IVF and documented it, and they had leftover embryos at the end, and they gave them to us. And we just said, you know, we can't afford the rent on our embryos anymore. If you guys give us the money, we'll pay another month. But if you don't give us the money, we're going to let them defrost. And, you know, I mean, they're a schedule for termination anyway. And, yeah, I mean, their fate was sealed. So we just thought, okay, we can have some performative fun with this. The next day, you know, it's like the rest of the performance, totally forgotten. Headline in the paper, let's kill baby. I was like, oh no. And then you know what happens when you start killing babies. You know who's coming. You know who's coming. Yeah, the Catholics are coming. Yeah, the Protestants, they're coming. And they were out in force. Man, there's people yelling. And it ended with the Archbishop of Salzburg challenging me to a debate. And I was like, this can't be happening. You know, we're just trying to do a simple work. You know, a simple theatrical performance, and here I am, I'm having to go on to primetime Austrian television to debate the Archbishop, who didn't really want to talk about this at all. He just was using us as a way to get on TV to rail against abortion. And, well, I did learn, the only thing I can really say about this unfortunate occurrence was I learned that don't accept a debate if you don't speak the language. Because you're at a real disadvantage. So that's the only lesson I can say out of that one. Okay, Cult of the New Eve. Now you're saying once again, how can this be a problem? This was a problem on both ends. And I learned something about Germany on this one I never knew. Anyway, we started this project at the grand opening of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Toulouse. And it was a big day for them. I mean, people were coming from all over the countryside. There was a huge line of people. I mean, I could not believe how many people were wanting to come in to see their new museum and the gigantic Picasso that they had. It was like the size of that wall back there. Everyone wanted to see the big Picasso. And, you know, so they had invited us, and, you know, when we do our pieces, we like to be in, if we're in museums, we tend, not always, but most of the time, like to be in a place that's kind of neither nor. You're in the museum, but you're not. Like in cafeterias, hallways on the way to the toilet, lobbies, places like that is generally, rather than being in the galleries, because then you have too much art baggage to carry if you're there. So we're set up in the lobby, and you can see we're there in force, and what this project was basically about was all of the religious metaphors and rhetoric that was being used to sell the Human Genome Project, right? All of these things of, you know, that, well, the promise of immortality, right? The oldest of all Christian promises. But as immortality and Edenesque abundance and God's blueprint and all of this very odd language that was being used because you couldn't use the usual language of utopian technology, right? What works for computers does not work in the biological. You know, you can't start saying, oh yeah, you know what, we're going to build you a new body. You're going to like it when we're done. You know, that makes people nervous when you tell them that. You know, when you tell them that to the computers, you know, you will have extension of sight and be able to see around the world and Google Maps and whatever else, that's good. Right? We accept that. But when the biologists start telling us new body time, that rhetoric goes very, very badly. So the only other rhetoric common to the West that can take its place, that has a promissory future note to it, was Christian rhetoric, which is why we believe there was all this bizarre talk. And so we took this rhetoric out of the mouths of the authoritative scientists and said, what is the social constellation people will never believe, no matter what they say? And we thought, that's a cult, right? Cult can tell you the sun's coming up tomorrow. It's like, you've been brainwashed, man. Don't talk to me. So that's how we figured we could maybe inject some skepticism for people about how this discussion was taking place and that it could be a little bit more critical than it was being. So anyway, we're at the museum. and tons of people at the door. And the curator comes over and says, you know, I probably should have told you this earlier, but we made cults illegal last week in France. I'm like, yeah, you could have told me that sooner. So we're standing, the doors come flying open, people come mobbing in, and just, you know, because they're in their brand new museum, right in the lobby, the first thing they see is this big cult waiting for them. Oh, man, so people are going nuts about that. And they're really not happy with us. And so the complaints are flying. Some people liked it. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't categorical. There were lots of people that thought it was really fun what we were doing. But there were some people who were deeply offended. And apparently there were enough of them that by that afternoon, late afternoon, the mayor is over and he is livid of why is there a cult in their new museum. And the curator, he backed us up. He tried to explain it and said that's why, you know, there's a cult and it's just a performance, which actually started a huge debate of whether or not performing a cult was illegal. I know, that's bizarre. So it's like, we can't even perform being a cult anymore? We're not really. Anyway, we leave France. and come here to Germany, to ZKM. And one of the things that we were doing was we were giving Cult of the New Eve communion to our new members, those who would join. And, you know, part of our argument was why we were so much better than religion, because we were the religion of science, was that when we make a promise, we keep it. So you can go down the street and, you know, get a wafer and some wine, and it's supposed to be the body and blood or something like that. But when you come here and you get the wafer and wine, you're really getting New Eve. Because we had taken that, we had gotten the DNA, random DNA library, from the first donor to the project, and we spliced it with yeast and made brewer's yeast and made beer and cookies with it. So that when they came, we would say, you're getting, when we say you're getting the body of Eve, you're getting every single piece of DNA of the body of Gene Eve. And people did drink it. We used the German recipe, Hefeweizen, yeah. That was good. So I thought it was awesome. Anyway, I'm at ZKM, and I'm given my fiery sermon of why everyone needs to be a part of the cult. And I'm getting heckled. Someone's yelling about purity in the audience. It's like, why is someone yelling about purity in the audience? And at the end, we go and we pass around the beer. No, that's not us passing around the beer. Anyway, passing around, and people, some are drinking it, some are going, I would prefer not to. I don't need any transgenic beer, thank you. And this big guy comes walking up to me. He's like, man, this is probably not going to be good. And he reads this beer police. I was like, come on, you're not beer police. You're beer police. And I was like, no, we're not going to be arrested for beer. Please tell me it's not true. And he let us off with a warning. But he said, nope, don't bring any more transgenic beer to Germany. That's not acceptable. I asked him if he wanted to try it. I thought he might. I was like, well, you want to try it? I think it's a pretty good beer. We use the German recipe. He's like, no, I've sworn an oath not to drink anything but pure German beer, thank you. And so I will not be trying any of that. But I just thought, you know, that was one of the weirdest experiences I ever had with disciplinary problems. It's just, you never know where it's going to appear or what's going to set it off. I mean, you know, cultural difference. It's it can make for some rather odd forms of authority. And, you know, unhappily, we told him we only brought a six-pack. I think that's part of the reason that we got off with a warning, because it's not like we brought a keg in or something. It was just the modest amount. Molecular invasion, it's over. This was one of the pieces that was confiscated. They took all our seeds, which was a drag. But what we were attempting to do here was to find a biochemical means to basically kill Monsanto Roundup Ready products. And we are pretty sure we can do it. Now, this is one time we were actually doing real science, because normally we're just using scientific materials and processes. We're not like really investigating in a scientific manner. But this time we were. And none of us are scientists, so this was the first problem. And none of us certainly have much knowledge at all of biochemistry. But we knew who did. Monsanto did. And when they patented these plants, a problem right there, patenting life, they had to put all of their experiments on the plant into the public domain. And so we were able to look under enzyme disruptors in their experimentation, and we found the chemical vitamin B6 enzyme, pyridoxal 5-phosphate, that actually had a photocombustion reaction with the plant. So if you kind of mix that in sunshine, it seemed to be that it would kill the plant. So we thought, okay, well, let's go ahead and give this a whirl. We know it doesn't hurt the environment. It's actually good for people, but it seems to be bad for this plant. I'll save you a lecture on how Roundup Ready works, but it's basically an implantation of a bacterial gene, and that was the gene we wanted to attack. Right? So it was all about targeting, or finding a chemical that would work only on that plant due to its relationship to the introduced gene. Right? Needless to say, the FBI really didn't like any of this. Man, this was all through the warrants when I was charged the paperwork that charged me with mail fraud, they had written it all in there that we had done this. Anyway, we did this project at the Corcoran, which is a museum right down the street from the White House, and we did it with the help of the students from the school that's there, the art school that's there. So, it was going along swimmingly, and it was covered very well in the newspapers that this was happening, and sure enough, I don't know how far we were, maybe a week into it, and all of a sudden, just suits everywhere in the gallery. It's all of these lawyers from Monsanto, and they're waving cease and desist letters, they're taking photographs of everything. And it's like, oh, this looks bad. I don't know how this is indeed going to turn out. Well, we didn't cease or desist. We went ahead through with it. In fact, did this public experiment a number of more times, most notably in Amsterdam. And nothing really happened. I don't know what they could do. I think it was mainly a bluff, though it was quite a spectacle that they put on to stop this kind of behavior of using the lawyers to leverage what is going to happen. But we
went on with it, and it seemed to blow over after that. I don't think they thought they could afford the bad publicity they would get if they attacked and tried to sue the Corcoran. This is one of those times of what you were saying, how a museum can really be helpful in some projects. This is like the perfect example. They gave us total cover to be able to do something that if we had done it almost anywhere else, we would have been arrested. Even though everything we did was legal, except maybe the seeds. That's questionable. The seeds we got, but I'll just tell you about the seeds, because that would have been interesting if there was an argument over it. Because you do have to be licensed to use the seeds and grow things. But we dumpster dove them. So legally, anything that's in a dumpster, we're able to take away is considered trash and no longer property. And so we felt we could take them then.
This is Claire Pentecost did this. She was the genius that came up with this plan. She went out, because she lives in Chicago, so it was no trouble for her. She just went out to the country to where there were seed stores. And she went around asking if someone would give them seeds. And she finally stumbled upon this one store where the woman said, well, I can't really give them to you or sell them to you because, you're not licensed to have them. But, there's some busted bags here and I'm going to be throwing them out in the trash. Today. So that's how we got hold of the seeds to do this. Leverage with lawyers. We've had a number of run-ins with them lately too, especially after we now have our illustrious reputation. Quite often, this is a bad thing about museums. When we go to museums now, notably the New Museum in New York and the Whitney, they have their lawyers there. It's like, oh, yeah, I come, because you know, you're never going to get it. If there's a lawyer in the room, whatever your proposal is, they're going to say no. It's just a given. That's basically their job, is to think of weird stories that's going to scare the curators that they're going to be sued. So, I hate those guys. Except my lawyer, who defended me. He's okay. We haven't found the refugee. But free range grains, that was one where we had a pretty extensive setup that, so that we could test the food. And needless to say, the FBI was not keen on that at all. That was one of the things where they felt like we really had overstepped our boundaries, even though it's all perfectly legal to have. And there's nothing you can do with it that's dangerous. That's the most annoying part of it all, is if you have a PCR, all you can do with that is grow DNA with it. That's all it does, right? You know, electrophoresis, all it does is tell you if you have the DNA you think you have. That's all it can do. It can't do anything else. You know, I don't know what they were thinking, but I did take it as a very bad sign when I, and this, again, going back to the exhibition, I took it as a very bad sign when I went in for my interview with the Joint Terrorist Task Force head of biosecurity. I go walking into there, the guy's reading the Bible. I'm like, oh no, this is it. Because as you know, many of the people that read their Bible at work are generally pretty hostile to science. They don't particularly like it. They don't really understand it. And this guy was definitely one of those. He knew nothing about biology. He didn't know what any of the machines were. He didn't know what I was doing. He knew nothing about it. He just knew upstanding citizens shouldn't be doing science unless they're scientists. That's what he knew. And other than that, you should be reading your Bible. So... Yeah, so that was a bad problem, and it gave me great pause, and probably should give all of you great pause, that the head of biosecurity for the United States knows nothing about biology, which is a typical Bush appointment, right? Bush always appointed whoever was completely incompetent and knew nothing about it, you know. If you need someone for FEMA, for Emergency Management Agency, find some retard that used to be a horse judge. That's who we should appoint in. You know, and it was just like that with everything he did. And in this case, again, no exception. So that was part of my problem. I'm going to wind up. Unfortunately, I don't have the slides of it, but the film is next door. You go see the film that's in the back room, for those of you that might have looked at that already. When I was doing that film, we were recreating, as much as we did here, we were recreating experiments, germ warfare experiments. This particular one we did at the Isle of Lewis, we recreated the plague experiments, only with simulant. We didn't use real plague bacteria. We just used a bacteria that's harmless, that behaves like the plague bacteria. And we tried to shoot a platform of guinea pigs from a mile away with it, which we were not very successful doing, much as they were not successful doing it when they did it back in World War II, when England was developing its weapons program. But anyway, we were doing one in Leipzig, and we knew our target, the U.S. Embassy, because, you know, the U.S. has sprayed so many people with germs, it was time payback. And but we didn't know where to do it from. We're driving around, and we go by the city hall, and it's got that great, huge observation tower. And I was thinking to myself, that would be the perfect spot. But then, also thinking to myself, sure, we're going to go into that building, go to the security people, the person in charge of that platform, and say, we need to use it Saturday. We know no one's here. Just give us the keys. We'll be a bunch of guys. We're going to have a lot of equipment. I'll run some power up there for us. There's going to be smoke. There's going to be some smoke, but don't pay attention to that. And we'll let ourselves out when we're done. I'm just saying, it's not even worth doing. It's not, you know, why trouble ourselves over that? Though it would look great if we could actually do it. And the curator said, no, let's go ask him. And basically, he went in and said that. We're coming in, we're going to need some power, just give us the keys, we'll let ourselves out, there'll be smoke. I mean, the whole thing. And they went, okay. Right. So, you know, that my hat's off to you here. And the other one, too, is because we had a parade. We had these guys that we were marching around with because we figured our human guinea pig corps, which was a real thing. It's actually based on an American troop that was of these religious guys, Seventh-day Adventists, and they were pacifists, and they went to the military saying, you know, we're not going to fight because we don't kill people, but, you know, we're not afraid to be put in harm's way. And so the military said, well, we got a job for you. We're going to test all our germ warfare stuff on you. And you should see these films. I mean, it's like these Seventh-day Adventists sitting in lawn chairs out on the range. They got like a monkey next to them and a dog. And they start bombing with plague or whatever, anthrax or whatever they were using that week. See what happens to them. So we recreated that corps too, and we figured there really needed to be a parade to the consulate. Those guys were great too. You know, I really enjoyed them. And so, you know, we made a good deal of noise and everything. And the curator said, and I'm going to contradict myself here, said, I got to call and tell the police we're doing this. I was like, are you kidding me? You're going to tell the police we're doing this? He's like, yeah, I'm going to tell them. So he calls up and says, hey, you know, we're going to have a parade. We're going to be marching around some in the middle of town. Is that okay? They were like, are you going to cross any major streets? I said, no. Police are like, what are you calling us, fool? I don't care about that. You know, it's parade away. Apparently you guys can have parades and it's no big deal. So, you know, it was two times, and I end on this one because it's like the security state can get in your head. And I don't care how radical or critical or reflective you are, it gets in there. And, you know, I was on that, I was my own worst censor. I was about to start my own project without even asking or trying, just going, no, security state's dead. So, you know, it's those times that, you know, you have to always remember that the resistance is constant and you've got to be willing to engage it. Even though, as I've said, there can sometimes be real consequences for it. And a lot of, if nothing else, a lot of aggravation and frustration. But I think this is kind of the real charge for artists these days that are working in public space. That's probably our main goal, is to keep that space, to keep that place where there can be a social sphere expanding, and where expression management systems are at least kept as minimized as possible within the sphere of legality. Because that's where the struggle is. Like, I have lots of students that are like, they want to do this illegal stuff, they want to change billboards, or they're going to vandalize something, or, you know. And it's like, let me tell you, you don't have to do that to get involved in that kind of struggle. Right? And in fact, it's best you don't, because where we really need the people working are in these gray areas that are soon going to become black areas. And, you know, that's been the focus, and, you know, I hope, you know, when I look around, I see a lot of it going on, so I'm hoping you're going to join in with me on that notion. Thanks very much. If you have questions or want to talk or anything like that, I'm available both formally and informally, right? Are we going to sit here for a minute to see if...
Thank you, first of all, Steve.
Oh, no,
thank
worries.
You so much. Maybe some very, very tricky questions for you. Projects, present. Did you have a question?
I wonder how far FBI was examining critical accounts and activities. Did they meant also for publications, or it was mostly, like, say, looked down projects and actions?
They examined us pretty well. Very thoroughly. Because they had all my computers, so they went through all our files. Mm-hmm. They definitely read all our books, because they quoted them in a number of the legal documents. Yeah, I never knew there was some guy that just sat there reading books all day, but apparently they've got someone that does that. They subpoenaed so many people. All our close colleagues got subpoenaed and had to testify before the grand jury, which is the investigative body of the Justice Department. And they went around to almost every place we had shows and questioned the curators, and that's how we got our bad reputation, why there's lawyers in the room when we show up places, because they've been afraid the FBI is going to come again. And they even went as far as to call secret services overseas, including Germany, to, and had them look into activities we had done in other countries. So, yeah, we were very, and I was followed for a long time, 24 hours a day. So, yeah, we were really thoroughly investigated. They really wanted to put us away.
But it's a threat to books somehow and charges against you?
Yeah, they did. Oh. I mean, for, it was, you know, it's and the reason they did that is not that they could charge me for anything. All of that is constitutionally protected speech, and I had the lawyer that could enforce that. It was there more to make the judge be more suspicious. That's why they were using, you know, and they took the quotes all out of context and tried to make them into things that they weren't.
So did anybody call you from FBI about this
Not then, no. I was very attentive while the opening was there.
We're not being investigated right now. No. That investigation is closed. Although the file is open, they could resume at any time they want. But I don't think they're... I haven't heard of anyone being talked to in a long time now, either.
Yeah, I have a
tentative
question while we're together. And something else later on. Would there be a difference about all these interesting performances you were presenting, who you called, and how do you now that you repeat the performances after the period between 2004 and 2008?
Would I repeat them?
Yeah.
Well, we usually don't work that way. We do a performance till we feel like we're done doing it, and then we don't ever do it again. Because it is, you get calls from curators all the time, could you recreate Flesh Machine, or could you maybe just don't do it? Because the projects that we do, it takes our full attention, and we have time to go back and revisit. You know, we're pretty much into the idea of constantly moving forward, and trying not to go back too much.
Speaking about present projects, so possibly just for the very end of our talk, to tell us a little bit about upcoming projects.
The upcoming project we're doing is we are working on the use of radiation for state propaganda and how people's oftentimes very non-rational fear of radiation is used as a means to get them whipped up and afraid. And in the U.S., the key sign, I guess, that's been used is the dirty bomb. And this was it came into the American imagination in 2002 with the Jose Padilla case, and they were trying to claim that this incredibly uneducated person was somehow capable of building a bomb that would have a radioactive component, and you know, we'd all get radiation sickness and die after this terrorist act. And you know, trying to create the attempt is to create a plausible form of a weapon of mass destruction. But anyone that knows the science knows that the concept is fairly ridiculous. Not that something like it couldn't be done, but that it would ever be anything more than a weapon of mass destruction is exceptionally unlikely. And so, you know, the project we're working on now, and we've done kind of the book research for it as well as the research for the project, would be to kind of to do an illustration of this. These are harder projects. I mean, recently we've been doing a lot of anti-war work, and when you get into these weaponry projects, we can't do kind of the same we did with Marching Clay, but a lot of the times we can't get into the same kind of participatory theater that we like because it's too dangerous. You know, the last one we were doing was incendiary weapons and we were using white phosphorus, so it really doesn't lend itself to audience participation. You know, it's some one of those things. It has to be mediated in some way. And we're kind of like caught with this again as we build our dirty bomb.
In the exhibition, a lot of what you were documenting there was the things that were confiscated during the investigation. I was just curious if you've looked into or if there was any effort, now that the case is closed, of getting those materials back. Is there a legal way for that, or is it...
No, there is a legal way, and a lot of the stuff we did get back. In spite of that, we didn't update the seized website, which I guess we should have, because it says, you know, that it wasn't returned. A lot of stuff was returned. A lot of stuff wasn't returned. You know, they kept all the wetware. They weren't going to give us back our bacteria or our seeds or our reagents or any of that, which is too bad, because that's the most expensive stuff, especially those reagents. But the hardware, they had to give the hardware back, and they had to give my books back, and they had to give my computers back. But, you know, by the time I got my computer, you know, it's 5 years old, it was like 7 years old then, it was like totally out of date, it's useless junk anyway. But at least I could get some of the information I lost back.
What about the job at the university?
The university, they were very supportive about it. My hat's off to my university. You know, my colleagues were really good about it. My students were great. They did everything imaginable. Fundraisers, letter writing campaigns, teach-ins, everything they could think of to do. And also were very forgiving with me when I was like having to miss class a lot and such, like due to the various other obligations I had, particularly when I was on probation. So that was fine. The union was pretty good. They were a little slow to get going, but once they got the wheels turning, they were helpful. Upper administration, they were a lot more standoffish, but they felt like they couldn't comment on it one way or the other. Being a state organ on one hand, yet wanting to support their faculty on the other. But they did promote me to full professor, so I take that kind of as a signal from them that, you know, we can't say it, but, you know, we're on your side of this. So, yeah, the university was great. I never had any moment of insecurity in spite of the fact that the FBI did go to the president of the university and demand my immediate firing. And part of FBI strategy is to pauperize. I mean, that's pretty traditional, just to try and get you as down and out as possible because you become much easier to prosecute. They tried it with everyone. You know, they went to all the spaces and said, "Don't ever show these people again." You know, they're troublemakers and rabble rousers.
They did
this. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, they certainly did that. But who's going to listen to them? You know, some art space is going, "Yeah, I'm going to listen to the FBI. That's a good thing."
They came in. They said, "We have from the FBI."
Yeah. Not only did they do that, they subpoenaed some of the curators we had worked with. They made them come and testify before the grand jury. Mm-hmm.
Did the Dirty Bomb Project, are you considering the promotion you also have with the Department of Defense?
With that?
Because of the shells that are used by the United States forces up in Iraq, we're using Bosnia or Kosovo.
Yeah, well, we're not going to use depleted uranium.
Yeah, I was going to say,
and a lot of this, all the bomb stuff, all of this is contracted out. It's contracted. Yeah, I mean, what
is everything done every day
about bombing? Yeah. Know anything about it, then, you know, I'm not really intending to learn. I'm ready to defer to the experts on that. I'm not going to become the amateur bomb builder. We'll defer to the experts on that one. So, yeah, again, yeah, we have all the contacts that are ready to do it. All we have to do is kind of get the go-ahead from the space that's sponsoring the project. Off we go. We got the people to film it, everything.
And
what was
the question? I was just about the university and whether parents of the students, more because they didn't know you, but they just maybe read through the media. But I know the art press was kind of supportive, maybe the local press or.
Yeah, the press was all really supportive. It was the first week. It was bad. The first week it was pretty bad because. The Justice Department kind of gave a surprise press conference the moment that I was indicted, and which is really bad form. You know, I mean, they did so many bad things in this case. They're supposed to inform my attorney before going public with it. So my attorney hears about it for the first time also through the press. So there was nothing to contradict them, which is why they did it. So they got this first round of press of, you know, new terrorists found in Buffalo. But once I had a really good press team that was coordinated by the Yes Men and another CAA member, Lucia Summer. And they had it turned around within about 5 days. Because we had a much larger press list. We knew a lot. We had way more contacts. And, you know, these guys were good about the press releases. And so it had been turned around. And within a week or so, it was the Justice Department that was the bad guy.
Even in the mainstream media,
that's true. I mean, this was such an egregious case, and journalists took it to heart, right? You know, they could see them in my place. So they were very empathetic with this happening. And so, yeah, a lot of them really kind of lost their neutrality when they came across this. So the press was good on my side, and we never had a complaint from a parent. You think you might, but I don't recall there being anyone going, I don't want my child exposed to this man. I don't think that was a problem. And in Buffalo, I enjoyed considerable support. I never had one person, you know, say, you terrorist, I hope they put you in jail forever. You know, not one time. Every time it was just, oh, you know, we're rooting for you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so there was no real problem that way.
Well, maybe
that
comes to the end. maybe just a bit more information. It's possible now. I mean, that was such a wonderful talk and so many interesting aspects and debates and questions. So we would really love to be a little bit longer together with you. And I also wanted to say that we were so fortunate to get that space here. That is the first time that we have actually expanded space, a creative space here, this sort of seminar room. It belongs to the Glasshouse, to the theater. And thanks to Cassini, the director of that Togolese restaurant, she opened us the door, and we did not have to deconstruct our exhibition in our gallery. So the thing is, I would like to thank Cassini maybe in a way that we have a drink in the restaurant, there may be something to eat, which I highly recommend. So maybe afterwards, if you have time for a good morning, you can just sit here and root and also enjoy the presence of Steve. That would be only a nice thank you for receiving. And maybe a little tiny sort of an advertisement for our own institution. I would also be so happy if you would be interested in our catalog. We produce an exhibition catalog in German and in English, where you can read parole about the case and also a statement by Philippa Arachovo, 2004, and also an introduction essay from Chris and me, also reflecting about the artistic value that the project sees. And we just sell it for a little donation, €5, it's sort of like being away from the middle for free. So we have catalogs here or in the exhibition space. We have it still open if you also want to have a look at the exhibition. Later, maybe gather here.